This podcast is brought to you by the Association for Child and Adolescent Mental Health, ACAM for short. You can find more podcasts and other resources on our website, www.acamh.org, and follow us on social media by searching ACAMH.
Okay, so can you tell me a bit about how our time came to be, how you came to enter the field, and whether there was any particular life experiences that shaped your career?
Alan?
Well, I've been a family therapist since about 1972, and started the Association for Family Therapy and started the Institute of Family Therapy, and I was always preoccupied with the fact that we weren't really applying what we knew in the key area of adult mental illness. And we set up this project in Camden Islington, which they'd been supporting until about 2010. And there we were interested in how do we get frontline mental health workers to think about this. And so eventually we got a training, we got a university qualification attached to it, and we trained a lot of staff. But we found that, of course, the problem is we didn't change the organisation. And as a result, many staff who really found the course very helpful didn't want to go back to their basic workplace because they felt it wasn't being recognised or used. Anyway, we noticed that nobody seemed to touch the children of parents with mental illness. And eventually, one of my colleagues said, you know, we ought to do something about this. So we looked at some of the work of Bill McFarlane on multifamily groups. And we said, well, we can't do that. We're not resourced. But what we could do is run a day workshop, which we did start. But still, we had no children. And then he said, well, look, it's time we did something else. We need to help parents talk to their children about what's going on. So in the year 2000, precipitated a lot by a landmark conference called Keeping the Family in Mind in Merseyside, we, without knowing what the heck we were doing, we started a Kids Time workshop. Hottest day of the year in a really ghastly building of St Pancras Hospital, and the first day of the school holidays, and it was quite an experience. And we hadn't thought about enough about the sort of families who'd be there, and we found that there was a very internally sexually abusive family, and so we learned fast, and very quickly we came up with the structure of what then became called the Kids Times workshops, because they wanted to change, the young people said we must change the name to something that relates to us, not just the parents. And from then on, we've been running these multiple family groups for 2.5 hours after school once a month, initially just in Camden Islington, now in about 17 places around the UK and some abroad, which are both a combined joint groups between parents and children, separate groups for the parents and children, parents to think about their role in having a mental illness, and the children, we use drama and help them articulate what they think is going on and think about it. And then the children produce dramas, which they film now, and then we show the films to the parents at the end and discuss it. That's it, really. We don't demand any personal disclosure, although we often have it. Now, they were so exciting, and we felt they were so successful that we thought we really needed to do something about rolling this out to a larger population. So that was what led us to work hard on designing the Who Cares project for schools. And also we thought, well, to really promote all this, we need a separate charity. And so as a result, we set up the Kids Time Foundation in 2012, changing the name and rebranding the whole exercise now to Our Time.
Firstly, can I ask, how did you come to get involved with Our Time, and Were there any particular life experiences that have shaped your, you know, shaped your life and why you're now involved with this organisation?
Yeah, so my involvement with the organisation began as a member of the groups, so a beneficiary. I went to the groups that Alan described, called the Kids Time Workshops, with my father, who had bipolar, and my twin sister. So my father was a single parent, so to me, my sister, so a lot of the care and the gaps that were left by his illness, you know, we had to fill, and took a lot of care of my dad. Luckily, I did have the workshops as somewhere to go to help me think about why my dad was limited in certain ways, confusing behaviour, and it helped me learn how to prioritise myself in those, in that family situation as well. It helped so much, and I'm in a really unique position where I now use my own experience to help widely as part of the organisation to help disseminate the message of we must help the children understand what's going on, and I give recommendations based on what has helped me, and that happens to be the Kids Time workshops and our time. So yeah,
excellent, thank you very much. Jess, how would you describe the current support for and understanding of this group of people? And where does the child fit into all this, and how are they actually supported at the moment?
That's a very interesting question. I think, my background is school nursing and nursing generally, and working with looked after children. And I would say from my experience and from everything I've learnt whilst working with my colleagues here, that there really isn't a place for the children in generally. Adult services relate to the person that they see for treatment, which is a parent, but they don't think of them as a parent. They think of them as a patient. And that it's very often that the actual child and the impact of the parental mental illness is lost. People aren't considering that, and often when children are in school and they're suffering a lot of difficulties at home linked to this, they may not have they may just sort of be under the radar, so it's not as though they're necessarily the kind of presenting the kind of issues that make people think we must do something here, but they will probably be late for school quite often. They will find it very hard to concentrate when they're in school because they're preoccupied with other events, hard to do their homework. Often they're classed as young carers, but for them they would never identify as young carers, so actually at the moment they don't really fit in, and there isn't provision. We also don't count these young people yet. We don't literally count them. We don't have any statistics in this country on children who have a parent with a mental illness, which we really do need to do.
Kirsty, from your perspective, what's the impact of children of not intervening at an early stage, and what are the positive impacts of intervening as early as possible?
I think society don't want to, we have a specific view of what children should be and a quite romantic idea of what childhood should be, and idealistic, and because of that a lot of people don't want to acknowledge these age inappropriate responsibilities that children have when they're caring for a parent with mental illness, and because of that we don't offer support, we don't recognise these children's need, and as a child who does not have those experiences validated, they continue on thinking that they are not the priority, thinking that it is their rightful place to take care of everyone else. And if you don't from a young age learn to prioritize yourself and have confidence in things that are outside of your parent and your parent's illness, that's going to have really lasting effects, because you don't think that you deserve help and deserve support, which is what children should get, and should, and hopefully children have developed healthily, think that they're deserving of that and that's their right. And the parts of how my dad's illness impacted me that I didn't receive support with, like constantly having things in the background, worrying about what I've got to do next, what might happen with my dad, it was a lot of anxiety. And the impact of that was I had my fingers in so many jars, if you think about it. I had such an endless list that I was never going to complete it, and so I went around as a young child just feeling really like a bit of a failure, quite critical of myself, very busy, very disorganised. And actually that, to someone else, to an adult or another child who doesn't have my responsibilities that I had, I was probably quite an impressive person. person, but I didn't think that I was myself. So that really impacted my schoolwork because I just didn't have that, the foundation of confidence that I was going to succeed in it. And really, it was just something that so often was marginalised by me. It wasn't on my top list of priorities. But on the other hand, the help that I did receive in terms of going to Kids Time, it was somewhere where they really celebrated me outside of my dad's illness. So that means my successes at school, my successes in extracurricular activities. They encouraged me, and they encouraged my dad to encourage me to do those things and recognise my successes in them. And that really helped me grow in confidence and realise that that was what the appropriate thing for my age was. And that later on, in terms of education, I felt good at things outside of the home and not just being a carer, and that really helped me with education.
Didn't some teachers treat it just as a discipline issue, and it might have been amazingly helpful if they hadn't?
Yes. I did act out when I was doing my GCSEs, I think when the pressures got more increased with school, so they just really didn't look underneath it at all. And actually, that coincided with really severe episodes of my dad's illness. So, yeah, they just didn't look underneath.
Alan, if you could choose one country and one example a notable experience that the UK could draw from, what would it be and what country would it be?
Well, the obvious country is Australia, because they actually have acknowledged the existence of children of parents with mental illness, which they have which they call COPME, and they did have a central government department. But other countries also, other than the UK, have been addressing this, particularly in Canada and Holland. But I think in terms of standardised approaches, Australia probably leads.
What are your hopes for the development in this field in the next coming years?
Thank you for that question. I think we had a very recent launch at the House of Commons, and I felt so proud because I felt really for the first time we're getting there now. The climate's right for mental health is on the agenda now. It's on the whole political agenda. And what we need to do is we need to make sure that there is early intervention in place, that there's preventative work, because this isn't about treating people who are ill. This is about preventing the next generation from becoming unwell and helping them to develop resilience. So I think we're at a pivotal point now where our message can really be spread far and wide, and I'm hoping that conferences such as your own will really go a long way to doing that.
Excellent. And the final question, we've had a really good turnout today in the inaugural training. I guess the final message I want to try and give to prospective delegates coming forward is, what are the key benefits? What can delegates expect to get from turning up to training today? What can they take away and actually put into place when they get back to their place of work or their families from leaving this event?
Well, I think two things. First of all, one is that we're helping them point their minds, if you like, in areas which they may just not have thought of, particularly like the impact of explanation, which is so important. And secondly, we would hope to give them some skills in thinking about how to address what may be seen as a taboo and very difficult subject with children, and how that can increase the child's resilience.
Excellent. Thank you very much.
This podcast was brought to you by the Association for Child and Adolescent Mental Health, ACAM for short.